Welcome to the Injumara podcast. This is episode 4. I'm Jack Jacobs.
I'm Stan Grant. How are you, Jay?
I'm very well, Stan. We're dealing with a bit of a shabby Wi-Fi today because you're in Sydney and I'm in Canberra, but we'll go ahead and do what we can.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Stan, I wanted to start off this week by talking a bit about our experience last week at the Warren Gesta Festival. We were on Wiradjuri country out for the festival, which is organized by your cousin, Kerry Johnson. And it was a really special experience being with Wiradjuri people on Wiradjuri land. What did that experience mean to you in the midst of 2023?
Well, first of all, it's important to be back on your own country. It's important to be amongst your own people, to be able to hear our language spoken, to be able to swim in our rivers, to walk on our land, touch our own skin, hear our own music, do our own dance. And that's the essence of being a First Nations person. That's the community, the society, the culture that I grew up in. I mean, I'm a Wiradjuri person. That's what I am. If anything in the world, that's what I am. Not Aboriginal, not Indigenous. I am a Wiradjuri person. That means something to me. Of course, I relate to other First Nations people and we share things, but I am Wiradjuri. My mother's Gamilaroi. I have deep roots there. I have Dharawal roots as well. But to be on our country and be amongst my people is the essence of who I am. Warren Gesta is a very important place. It's an old mission site from the 19th century that was set up to save our people. Our people were being slaughtered and at great risk of being wiped out. It was set up by a missionary. As with all those things, with the greatest of intentions, it didn't work out that way. And in his efforts to save us, in inverted commas, inflicted a lot of damage on us as well. But it's where we connect. And I can walk on that ground and I can stand under a tree where my great-grandmother was born. I can walk in the same earth as my own people. And what was important in this year was to center ourselves and know what it is to be Wiradjuri as the world swirls around us, particularly this question of the voice to power.
It was really interesting too for me, Stan, because as a non-Indigenous person being on Wiradjuri country with Wiradjuri people, hearing them discuss issues of sovereignty, of treaty, of culture, of nation building, which is so real and lived on the ground there, was an immersive experience that opened my eyes. You know, I think that particularly what arose was this great distance between the discussions around the voice in places like Canberra and Sydney and Melbourne, and the discussions that are happening out in on country. And, you know, I think this is what we're going to try and explore today in our conversation with Luke Pearson. We're really going to try and get a sense of what the political landscape is around the voice as it's emerging, as it's fracturing, trying to find a heartbeat for real First Nations people on the ground to think about what the voice looks like from their perspective and how we can best achieve justice for them. And, Warren Gez has really put me in that space of thinking.
The great thing is of course it does, because you're walking amongst us, and at a place like Warren Gez, back on our own country, you can step out of the world around us. You can immerse yourself into a different way of being, a different way of thinking, a different way of living in the world. And it's a pure, for me, it's the most pure way of being. It's the place that makes the most sense to me is amongst my own people. Luke's interesting because Luke is grappled with the sort of politics of the voice and written a very interesting article for Indigenous X where he talks about how we navigate this terrain. Not yes, not no, but all the arguments, all the spaces in between, all the various positions that people are taking, all the rhetoric, all the political spin. How do we work our way through that? How do we make sense of this in this year when it's coming at you from all sides? For me, it's very simple. I make sense of it by knowing who I am and centering myself amongst my own people. But there's a political process to navigate as well. And that's been the important role of what Luke has done with this article, is to really open up that political space.
Well, let's get into it. Cheers, Stan. So our guest today on the podcast is Luke Pearson. He's a Gamilaroi man and he's the founder and CEO of Indigenous X. And as Stan just mentioned, Luke's written a really important article in the past week about the voice, taking a very neutral, thoughtful and balanced approach to this fracturing landscape. And it's in the spirit of that article that we come to speak to him today. So, Luke, thanks so much for coming on the Injamara podcast, brother.
Thanks for having me, man. Nice to catch up.
Luke, we might start with that article. We might start with what drove you to write it. It's not an easy thing to intervene in a debate like this where there are various positions on each side that are becoming more and more inflamed. What drove you to write the article and what did you hope to achieve with it?
A lot of things. I think sort of I made some allusions to stuff in my own personal life. And I think like a lot of people, it's really only been the last few months that I felt some of that fog lifting of the past few years, and with that has come a bit of a renewed energy and interest. So obviously that interest is always there, but you know, when you're drowning under the weight of everything going on in life, it's hard to sort of pay attention. And so as that fog has lifted and I've looked around, I guess more than you know my own interest in am I going to be on the yes or no or what am I going to do with this issue, it was just looking at how much, you know, shit there is going on with like white fellas on each side hassling black fellas hiding behind other black fellas that they agree with, and how, you know, there's this, like I sort of said, that strong, you know, like it has to be yes, only yes, or the world will end. Has to be no, or the world will end. And I quite often in those spaces, sort of, I don't know, I guess you look for those gaps of where you're at. But I mean, obviously, if I'm strongly agreeing with one hand, then I'm like, yes, the world will definitely end if we don't do this. But this hasn't been that issue for me. I've been sort of sitting there going like, I don't know that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I don't know that everything has to rest on this. I'm not sure if there's a no that this is the last thing we'll ever get for the next 50 years and you know all of this really big hyperbole. So I just wanted to put my thoughts out just because I find that actually helps me with my own thinking just to sit down. And so I sort of sat down and wrote this really just for myself with intent to maybe share it with one or two friends. Part excited that I had that energy to write again and that I'm getting back to a bit of my old self. And then when I shared it, everyone was like, man, you've got to share this wider. And so I was a bit begrudgingly that I even put it online because it was one of those articles where it's like, oh, this is just going to cop me crap from yes mob and no mob and not make many friends in the middle. But yeah, that's not why I write, to make friends. So I kind of share my views and that's where I'm at the moment.
Well, if you're making too many friends, you're not writing the truth. That's the problem, isn't it? That's the problem. You know what really struck me about it, Luke, is there was a great honesty to it. And you come to this with an open mind and a good heart to say, okay, how do we grapple with this? Because there is not one answer. There is, you know, there's information coming at us from different angles. One of the things that really struck me about The Voice is that people can find a position, yes or no, but often for very different reasons. You can have the far right refusing it because they don't give black fellas anything. You can some of our mob saying no because they believe we deserve more. And then yes as well, you get white people saying yes because it's a modest proposal. It doesn't challenge Australia. It's only a voice. And then some of our mob saying yes because it will lead to treaty and truth. So there's so much here to grapple with. Even the yes and the no camps are not clear cut.
Yeah, I think that actually was a big part of the incentive of one of the things I really wanted to get out there was this conflation of, like you were saying, mob who are saying this isn't going far enough with the conservative no that says we don't want to give you anything at all. And then framing that as the same thing. And you see that, right? And then I think it carries a bit of sting for me because back in the day when I was, by the time I'd gotten to that point of saying, like, I do not support recognize, there was quite a lot of people who came at me at different times saying, oh, well, you're on the same side as Gary Johns and you're on the same side as, and I felt that sting because I very much was not on the same side as them. And so I think that was a part of my frustration in, because like I say, I'm a teacher more than I am a journalist by any stretch of the imagination. So that thing for me of what are the points, where's something I can dig my teeth into? And I think that was actually one of the really big starting points of this is not that simple. And a lot of the yes vote, like you said, aren't yes because they want to see, you know, the UNDRIP enacted, that they want to see Indigenous rights or they want to see a treaty. They're like, oh, this is great. This is non-threatening. This is people who supported an apology after they were confident they wouldn't have to give anything up. You know, they like, And not to say that this yes will lead to that. Like, I don't know where it will lead, but I can sort of read the psychology of some of the supporters and some of the opposition, and it's like, I don't like them. And that's I did make that note in the article of, yeah, whenever too many white fellas get excited about anything to do with any of our business, I get worried. Yeah. Because if it was ever that easy, yeah, some things are amiss in my mind. I have an innate distrust of mass white savior energy.
Yeah. You know what's really interesting too, Luke, and we were just talking before we joined you about a gathering of my own mob, Wiradjuri mob, at the old Warren Gesda Mission outside Darlington Point near Griffith in New South Wales. And that's a place where a lot of our people are rounded up and taken to. And, you know, I was saying before we came to you, I can stand in that place and I can feel my people with me. And, you know, when you're amongst your people and you've got the touch of their skin and the sound of their laughter and our music and our dance and knowing that you're truly home, one of the things that struck me in all my conversations is that there's a 30,000-foot conversation that's happening at a political level. And then there's the lived reality of mobs' lives. People who don't sit there and watch the drum and Q&A, who are not reading all the newspapers all the time, who frankly have got better things to do with their time, like keeping us alive, and they come to this very differently and often feel very alienated by the elite political discussion that never lands with them. Do you find that?
Yeah, it's a real issue, and it's something I'm mindful of. I mean, even with my own writing, like those of us who enjoy, you know, the written word, I think we have a tendency to be a bit too wanky about our own things as well. And I look at some of my own writing, and a lot of the time, something you really need a degree or you know, to be able to play at that level to access some of the content. And like I said, that's me just looking at my writing, and I do make an effort to write how I talk. But you know, I sometimes talk a bit wankily too, I guess. But then you think about, you know, the levels above that, like reading the reports, reading the level of thought out there, and it is, it's hard for mob to access it. It's hard for mob to participate in the conversation or to see any connection to their immediate day-to-day lives. And I think a lot of people just go on that sort of gut sense of, man, I don't trust government, or you don't necessarily trust
mob. And for good reason.
Yeah, well, that's, if you do trust government, I think you haven't been paying attention. But that's, yeah, I think it's different though to say, you know, like I do have a level of trust in Megan Davies and Arnie Pat and, you know, like some of the people I know who are driving. But that's looking at individuals and their faith and their commitment and their hard work and their passion and their belief. And I see that and I recognize that. But that doesn't necessarily mean I've got to sign up for the whole package of what's happening. Yeah. I think it's going to play out. And so that, I think, was the biggest struggle for me in putting that word out, is I didn't want to be dismissive or disrespectful of those mob doing that work, but at the same time, at the end of the day, we've all got to own our own vote and our own voice and our own opinions. And I've never been a fan of that idea of like, I support this because this person says this and this person says that, where at the moment, you know, you got Gary Foley over here who I got a lot of respect for saying this thing and someone else saying that thing. And so, like, so this is not an issue that's so simple as police are killing us, they need to stop. You know, even though God, that's obviously not simple in terms of getting it across, but it's very simple morally. Whereas this, it's like, obviously mob need a voice, but is this the voice we need? It's the voice we deserve.
And of course, Luke, I'm always reminded that mob are a lot smarter. I mean, when you're living it and when you know what daily life is and the struggle of your life and the love, that joy of being amongst your own people, you don't need to sit there and read a 200-page report because you know who you are in the world and you know where you belong and you know what matters. And again, you know, some of the questions aunties would ask me, some of the questions cousins would ask me would cut right through the political rhetoric. They would sit there and say, well, I don't trust this, or I don't believe that, or who's going to be involved in this and why should I believe that person? And you know it's coming from a place of just no bullshit, basically. Absolutely no, they have no... They're not trying to sell you anything. They're not trying to get a vote. They're just telling you as it is. And it's refreshing for us to go back. And for me, as someone who sort of does work at 30,000 feet and works in mainstream media, to just go back and sit with my people and just hear the truth.
Yeah, I think we can all use that dose of reality coming in, and that's how I really did try to write from that place of humility and thinking about some of the conversations I've had. But like I said, there's so many people where this just isn't on the radar, but that's not to say they're not going to be affected by the process, the outcome, and want to participate in the conversations. But the more we make the process inaccessible, then the harder it is for people to ask those questions and to have those voices heard. And then the more likely you are to disengage with the process when you don't feel like you are being listened to or are being heard. And so, you know, there is so much that goes on in this. And that's, again, I think that white savior energy that I'm always so worried about is that, no, we know what's best for you. And you know, that idea that you don't know what's good for you because you just don't understand. You know, and you see so that really condescending attitude. Like I said, particularly from non-Indigenous supporters on either side. And that's, you know, that rhetoric of like, oh, this person, they've just been duped by the white fellas who they don't really know, or you're a sellout who sold out your own mob because you run whatever. Like, I hate all of that rhetoric. Like, mob have agency, mob have dignity, mob know what is going on, even, but that doesn't mean we could all play it like constitutional law level, but that also doesn't mean that you still don't know your own lived experience, your own identity, your own history, and have your own future.
Yeah. On this, Luke, you know, I think what you and Stan are speaking to really powerfully there is sovereignty, right? So what I saw at Warringesda as a non-Indigenous person was sovereignty being exercised. I saw nation building in action. I saw a people and a culture continuous and working to continue that into the future in terms of their cultural inheritance. One of the key questions with the voice is, you know, is this the first step on a path of reform towards treaty, or is this, in a sense, a secession of sovereignty? Where do you sit on that question? I know that you speak to it in your article and want to get your sense around that sovereignty question.
Yeah, again, I really feel I'm punching above my weight on that topic because I do not know how sovereignty sits at that international law framework. But my understanding of our sovereignty, our collective sovereignty, is that like the Australian government has never really acknowledged it in any, apart from the occasional politician who maybe starts saying it at the start of their bloody acknowledgement of country, that sovereignty was never ceded. But they don't acknowledge it exists. And so if we take it on that premise that, you know, we have sovereignty, it was never ceded. Mm. Australia founding itself as a nation state in ignorance of or being dismissive of our sovereignty sort of means that Australia lacks a core moral legitimacy. Yeah, for me, a legal legitimacy within our legal framework, maybe not in an international law level, again, above my pay grade. But for me, I don't see how anything they do through their processes by referendum constitutional change, you know, like if they just put in the constitution, like fellows don't have sovereignty, that doesn't mean we don't have sovereignty. So I don't think there's anything you could do in the constitution that would take away our sovereignty.
Yeah, which is essentially what the Constitution says, because the Constitution of Australia essentially says that this is the sovereign government of Australia, and therefore there is no other sovereign. We know that's not true because we've never given that up. What's interesting here, Luke, is whenever I'm back home and I look at the work that my father has done, for instance, around language and keeping language alive, you know, we say in our language, we're a niang, we're a mind. If there's no language, there's no people. We've kept ourselves alive by speaking our language, and young people now learning our language, by being together, by knowing our stories, by sitting by the river, by eating our food, by touching our skins. These are acts of sovereignty, and our nations exist, and they exist because we put the effort into making sure they exist. How much sovereignty can we exercise in spite of the fact that there is no legal and political recognition within the Commonwealth of that sovereignty? How much can we actually live as sovereign people?
Well, I think that's that space that we need to keep pushing and need to keep testing. And the more we can take back, you know, even those things of, yeah, the role of schools in teaching culture as opposed to, you know, because a lot of the time that's happening without us being involved. And so you'll have like a non-Indigenous teacher running the Didge group at the school where a lot of us, you know, in places where they didn't play Didge traditionally, and then they're ticking all these big boxes So I think for me, so much of that comes from the power to say no, like free prior informed consent. You know, I often, it's something we talk about in the training work that we do, or the education work that we do, where we talk about welcome to country and how powerful it is for a lot of mob who grew up without any recognition of their basic humanity, let alone their sovereignty, to be invited to give a welcome. But at the same time, if I welcome you into my house, it is firmly premised on the idea that I can unwelcome you. And so, yeah, we have the invitation to welcome, but we lack the power to unwelcome. And so I think that's those big things. I was just watching a trailer for the Reverend Dr. Janini Gondara's documentary that's just coming out. And there's a line in the thing where he's like, you know, your law is backed up by military, by guns. And that is the ultimate. So yeah, the limits on our sovereignty are that we try, we push, and they come down. And at the end of the day, they're the ones with the guns and the cages, and we don't. That's not how we exercise our sovereignty in the first place. But you know, that's the very real limit of all this talk of lawfulness and good government and reconciliation and whatever else. Like, Western sovereignty within Australia is backed up by guns, by force. Yeah. And so that is the limit of how far we can exercise ours is until they shoot us, which they've done before and continue to do in many, many very real and tangible ways today.
Mm.
But that said, look, what have we got to do apart from keep pushing?
Mm.
Yeah. Jack, one of the things I wanted to ask you, and then if you could reflect on this to Luke as well, is being a non-Indigenous person and coming into that space and being welcomed into that space where we were the other week, how much of yourself do you have to leave behind? I mean, what Luke's talking about there and what we live with is a Western coercive hegemony. The reality is that Western power has been imposed on countries at the barrel of a gun, and however much it sees its legal frameworks and its progressive politics as being redemptive, we live with the reality of that coercion, as Luke talked about. How much of yourself do you have to leave behind when you enter into that space, our own space?
Well, almost everything, Stan. You need to approach it like diving into a river, right? Because all of the Western models, you know, I've studied political theory, thinking about democracy, all of these sorts of things, they just don't fit the deep conception of a word like sovereignty, for example, in a place like Warren Gesda. You know, I think I walked out of Warren Gesda seeing sovereignty as entirely being about nation building, as it being about keeping alive the beating heart and soul of a people and exercising that through daily actions in every moment. It's not a political concept at all. So you need to leave behind the entire kind of set of Western political models that you're using to try and grapple with words like sovereignty when you enter into such a place and just sit in silence and listen. You know, I think I learned finally what Yinjimara fully means in Warren Gesda for that reason. It is diving into a river. It is sitting in silence with people who are exercising their sovereignty, who are remaining and affirming themselves as an ongoing people. And yeah.
So, sorry, Jack, just picking up on that, Luke, because that raises something that I think is a fundamental issue here in Australia. And whenever we engage with the political process, we lose to an extent. We know that. We know that what we're looking for is a greater voice in a country that was taken away from us. Even treaty is going to mean that we lose in the acceptance of the reality of the sovereignty of the Commonwealth. And I'm just wondering to what extent these things are compatible: our sovereignty, our nation status, our culture, our way of being, and a Western political, liberal, democratic construct. How do we square that circle, Luke?
Like I said, I get caught up in the conundrums of that, because there's this infinite paradox of, like, we have to live within these systems, and when you see the oppressive system, you look for ways to make it less oppressive. But like you said, the deeper you're going down the rabbit hole every time you do. And so it really is, you know, those old analogies of, like, you know, a starving man will sell his soul very quickly for a sandwich if you get him at the right time. So, you know, like, it's one thing to go, oh, no, well, we can't participate. Like, and I can remember there were people who didn't support the Raise the Age campaign to raise, you know, from 10 to 14, because they were like, no, we shouldn't, there shouldn't be any age. We shouldn't be putting anyone in cage. And I was like, that, I really appreciate that perspective, but at the same time, right in front of us was a campaign to get it from 10 to 14. And so, yeah, there are those times where I support the baby steps when I appreciate fundamentally it's going further down the rabbit hole into something that the long-term goal should be to get rid of those cages, to defund police, to abolish that prison system. But it's so hard not to take that little carrot that's dangling in front of you when you know that there are real people, real lives who can be tomorrow by doing it. So, like I said, I think sometimes it is, again, it's a bit of a privilege for those of us who get to operate, like I said, 30,000 feet or whatever above, that we can debate the morality of someone else's starvation in the immediate. Yeah. So while for me, I don't want to sell ourselves down the river, I don't want to take a sandwich for our sovereignty, tell that to someone who's starving there, you know what I mean? Like that.
Exactly.
And just on that, Luke, you know, do you think you can run those two processes at the same time? So on the one hand, can First Nations peoples like understands leadership on Wiradjuri country focus on nation building while at the same time invest like something like a voice to put more bread on the table in a more effective way? Like, can you run both of those things alongside each other, or does the second undercut the first, you think?
Well, I think we do run both of them at the same time and many other things at the same time, because again, we're not a homogenous entity, so we don't have any collective movement where we're all putting weight in this and all putting weight in that. And you know, I get stuck with that as well. Like, I'm part of that first generation, broadly speaking, that was told if you want to make change, you got to do it from the inside. Go and get a uni degree and get a job. And I'm also one of those fellows who sort of did that, you know, spent 5 years at uni and then 3 years in the job that I trained for before going, this is bullshit. I can't make any change from the inside here. I tried making change from the inside, perhaps a bit young and a bit naive and a bit ignorant of how that bureaucracy operated. But that, to me, is the fundamental lie of the modern age, that all of the change before our generation was made from the outside. And then as we started to get a foot in the door, they told us, like, if you want to make change, you've got to be real nice. It's got to be reconciliation, not activism. It's got to be get a job and change from within. But, yeah, when you're that 18-year-old going into that system, they will change you before you change them, the vast majority of times. And even keeping a hold of yourself through that process is really complex and really difficult, particularly when you're given those tools at places like universities for how to intellectualize, how to rationalize, how to, and there have been those times where you get caught up in that rhetoric and you can spend years there before one day you wake up and you go, oh, no, shit, this was just another, you know, lie of colonization and assimilation to get me to water myself down or to walk myself back or to tread more softly than I actually should have, which is really more to do with white fragility and white appeasement than it is to do with the best, you know, tactical means to affect change. But at the same time, I don't like when I see the mob on the outside always fighting with the mob on the inside, when it's like, I feel like we would be stronger together, even if we're not necessarily always on the same page or the same philosophy. But that was one thing, you know, like I said, you know, you write articles and they're just out there. You hope they have some impact on some people. But there was one little thing that I really liked that played out on Twitter, which was a couple of young ones, or younger than me, from what I could tell of them on Twitter, Indigenous people, having a conversation coming from yes and no's, but just entering it into it a lot more respectfully than I think they would have necessarily if the centerpiece for their conversation wasn't that article. I think leading in with that tone of saying, I want to respect mob. I don't fundamentally believe that most mob are doing this out of malice or ill intent, or I think most mob believe what they say. And that we just have, you know, not all, I'm not silly, like, but I think most mob, yes or no, are coming from that good place of they do want what is best.
Yeah.
And so to even have that basic respect and to give each other that basic benefit of the doubt when we're having these conversations, that's the only impact of the article. I'd be pretty happy with that, to be honest.
Well, it was a big impact, and it goes to who we are as a people. I look at a lot of the
the ugly side of it, you know, the dumping on people and the public sort of haranguing of people. And I think, well, that's what white people do. That's, I don't see that amongst my people. I don't see it when I go home. I don't see it amongst my aunties and cousins and my parents. We don't do that. And so I think you're right in opening up that space. That's a much more cultural space, frankly, of the way we culturally have these conversations. I'm just wondering, Luke, because so much of your work is really at the coalface, and you work with Indigenous X, and you do get to canvas a lot of opinions. You open up space for people to bring differences of opinion. And I'm just wondering where you're starting to find, even anecdotally, where people are sitting on this, because we hear a lot about opinion polling and, you know, this percentage support it and this percentage don't. And we heard that with the Recognise campaign, which you were able to debunk a lot of the sort of misleading opinion polling around that, which inflated the levels of support. Where do you think people are landing just from your engagement, listening, talking to people on this, on the broader question, if we haven't got into the detail yet, but on the broader question of fundamentally whether people support this reform with the voice or not, what are you picking up from people?
For me, I think there's far more of an even split, and I did write very plainly, I do not believe that commission survey of
300 people.
8%, yes, 10% no, 10% I don't know. I'll call that straight, but I don't buy that even remotely, just as I didn't recognise I had very similar numbers. I think there's probably a much more even split between the three camps, because I think there are a lot of people, like I said, there are definitely a bunch of people who are just like, are not going to be moved from their yes or no position, and they have every right to be there. If you're ready to lock your answer in, lock your answer in, go for it. But I think there are a bunch of us who are just like, I don't really understand the implications of constitutional law. I'm not really sure about these conflicting arguments. I do have respect for people on both sides. And so I think for a lot of us, that's a bit new in a lot of ways, because usually, like I said, the big ticket issues that we're taking on collectively, you know, stop black deaths in custody, treaty, like there isn't a strong split within community. It becomes very easy to go, man, I side with my mob on this one. Whereas when it comes to this, you know, like I respect people on each side. And so I do think there are a lot more people who could be moved to the yes or no side than is being acknowledged at the moment. And I am really mindful as well that even though I think I probably, like I said, I do get more access to a wider range of Indigenous views than sort of your average punter in the street, it's still very limited. We're talking hundreds, maybe, you know, a couple of thousand people who I get access to in different ways over, you know, extended periods of time. There's 800,000 of us, man. Like, you know, we're still very East Coast centric, always in how we access and who we hear from and how it's talked about. And so for me, I feel like I'm hearing a lot more people, and particularly people who reached out after the article, just going, you know, thank you for that. Like, it was, you know, one, just voicing the I don't know side. I think the I don't know side is much bigger than is being reported on. I think the no side is bigger than being reported on, again, when we're starting from an 80-10-10 base of conversation. But I think there are people who it's like, give me a reason to believe, you know, all of that stuff of, because I can remember, like, I attended one of the first regional dialogues where, you know, before they went out to all the regions, they had sort of three where they did one with like different groups. And I was part of the group where it seemed basically like the troublemakers that they had to sort of put in a room together. And I can remember at the time, there was some of the older mob who were there going, like, guys, this is our last big gamble. You know, this could be the last big gamble. We've got to go all chips on the table, all in on this one. This could be the last thing for 50 years. And with respect to some of that generation who've been doing this stuff since the 60s and 70s, I was like, you've probably been gambling with the chips for 50 years. What are you talking about? You're going to go all in on this last big gamble for the next 50 years? I don't even see them as my chips. They're my children's chips. What are you talking about? We're going to put them all at, like, but what? I don't fundamentally believe that a no would mean there's nothing that's going to happen for 50 years. I just don't. I don't understand that. There's a whole bunch of those things where it's like, is that just campaign rhetoric, or is that like, do people actually believe that? Is that a thing? Because what on earth is the logic for that? I don't understand it. I just straight up, I don't, I mean, no disrespect to anyone, I do not know what on earth you are saying when you say this is the last thing for 50 years.
Picking up on that point about campaign rhetoric, Luke, you know, I think certainly this the terms in which this has been cast by leadership, by the government as well, is in this kind of redemptive narrative arc. This is a nation-building moment for Australia. It's kind of, you know, the first step on to republic and all the rest. How do you sit with that narrative coming from the top down for the yes narrative as a First Nations person?
I mean, first step towards the, like, I think I'm part of that generation where as soon as the Queen dies, we'll become a republic. And it's like, well, here we are. So I don't think that this not happening, like, I see that as an inevitability. But in many ways, I see treaty as an inevitability as well, because it's one of those things where
interesting,
we're never going to give it up. And so, you know what I mean? Like, however long we got to wait for it, that's how long it takes. But I think treaty, as a great example, with a lot of these other conversations as well, like, treaty is the heading of a blank bit of paper. You know what I mean? Like, you could put a treaty in front of us where we go, well, this is crap. Like, why on earth would we want to sign this? But then also, you could put a treaty in front of us like, this is amazing. Look at all the wonderful things on this treaty. But then you've got to trust the other side to do it. You know, that was a big part of my opposition with that idea of doing it under Tony Abbott. Was like, I don't trust this fella as far as you can kick him. It's like, would you have really wanted to go into a treaty with Tony Abbott, with John Howard, with Scott Morrison? And I don't know that Labor are infinitely much better than them. That's what I sort of say. It's like Liberal generally try to just drag us backwards, and Labor generally are happy to leave us where we are. I've never felt a great sense of confidence in either party of wanting to move things forward. So that's that bigger question as well. Like, you've got all this public support for a yes, but what are the limits? Like, how far down the rabbit hole are the allies and supporters willing to go in this conversation?
Hey, Luke, I just wanted to finish with this, really. These things take a lot out of us. I don't know about you, but I've been feeling it quite heavily, and you know, we have to keep living our lives. We have to keep looking after our people. Sadly, burying our people, and I've been to funerals already this year, as we always are. I'm feeling very observed. The whole idea of people voting about us feels like a violation. And I'm feeling it incredibly personally, as people must have as well during the marriage equality debate. How are you feeling it, and what do you do to be able to live with this, to deal with what it does personally, what it does to mob, what it does to our psyche? How do you, what would you say to people confronting this and feeling it very deeply and very personally this year, to be able to just manage this and endure this?
I think that becomes the big thing for me. And you know, certainly since becoming a father and going into my 40s, you know, I'm still on the light side of 40, but I'm there now. And I think in my 20s, I had that same energy that a lot of mob who get into activism and who get into this sort of work feel of, like, I'll just burn myself out. I'll just keep going until I burn out, and that will be the end of me. And then you can bury me and the next one can take over. And that was the energy I brought. You know, when I started Indigenous X, I was all day, every day, like nothing but. I just lived and breathed. And, you know, I obviously did a lot before Indigenous X as well, but that's sort of where people knew me from. Whereas now I'm like, and be real, real careful about picking that hill that you die on. You know that saying? Like, I come back to that one a lot. And to be blunt, I don't think this is that hill for me. Like, I appreciate that some mob have been working on this for a very long time. I appreciate some of them have given a lot of themselves to this, and this is their hill. Whereas for me, I now am really mindful of my need to watch my children grow. And even, not just hit 18, but, you know what I mean, like, to be there while they're adults, to be able to support them and my family and community and my friends and myself, not just selfishly saying I've got to be there for my kids. I want to be there for me. I want to live a life. And so, you know, having that sense of proportion of, like I said, I don't think it's healthy giving that energy of this is all or nothing, do it right now or you'll never get anything ever again, because it breeds that sense of, like, okay, shit, this is killing me, but I guess I've got to stay because it's that important. And I don't know that that's healthy to communicate that to Bob, who really, and that's one of the things I wrote in the article, which is a bit tongue-in-cheek, where it's like, I haven't read the report and I'm probably not gonna. And a few people have been critical of that, and fair enough. Like, but at the same time, it's like, and I've got a long list of things I should do. You know, I mean, reading that report is one of them. But eating better and exercising more and spending more time with my kids and, spending more time on country, and they're all on my list too. And if I've got to put them in a priority order, reading the reports, listening to all the interviews, reading all the opinion pieces, fighting with all the racists online, that just isn't as high on my priority list as it once was, compared to I'll do everything that I can do for my mob. I always have, I always will. But what I won't do anymore is give more than I have. And that's something I'm really trying hard to do now.
Well, you give a lot, Luke, and the article was a really important article, and it set out the stall. You know, it came to this with an even-handed way, and as you say, it opened up a space for people to engage in the conversation. That in itself is worthwhile doing. So more power to you, mate, and thank you again for giving us your time.
Thank you,
Luke. Pleasure. Always nice to catch up.
See you, brother.